طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with the question, what does the defeat of Netanyahu and the establishment of a new government in Israel mean for the Palestinian people living under occupation? What does it mean for the Palestinian people when one right-wing faction takes over from another right-wing faction? As is often the case on This Week in Palestine, we turn to Ali Abu Nima, publisher of the Electronic Intifada, for his answer to the question. Here he is speaking on a news report from Amman, Jordan.
Let's get some analysis now. And joining me from Amman in Jordan is Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine book. Thanks so much for coming in on the show, Ali. I really appreciate. Let's not forget, Naftali Bennett has bragged about killing Arabs in the past. What is having a man like this in power? What does this mean for Palestinians?
For Palestinians, it's like you change the executioner. That's it. It's no different to having a new executioner. For the spectators, it makes a difference. But for the person whose head is on the chopping block, it makes absolutely no difference at all who is carrying the axe. And that's what the change of government means for Palestinians. But we're already seeing efforts to whitewash this new set of executioners in Israel by the so-called international community, who are welcoming it and even, talking about hopes that there will be a peace process and revival of talks about the two-state solution and this sort of thing.
Given the type of government that is now in power in Israel, is a two-state solution impossible? Is it off the table?
Well, actually, Naftali Bennett is even further to the right of Benjamin Netanyahu on this issue. And for the past decade, Naftali Bennett has been attacking Netanyahu from the right, claiming that Netanyahu is too willing to give the Palestinians too much. Bennett's policy is the annexation of almost all of the occupied West Bank without giving Palestinians living there any rights. So effectively, it's to formalize the situation of apartheid that already exists. That's who Naftali Bennett is. But we've already seen really delusional statements from, for example, Sven Koopmans, the European Union envoy, who's talking about looking forward to working with this government on peace. We've seen similarly delusional statements from Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, saying that he hopes that this government will swiftly move towards talking about a two-state solution. These are complete fantasies, and they're very damaging to Palestinians if people repeat them, because, as I said, this is simply a new set of hands holding the axe, but the neck of the Palestinians is still lying on the chopping block.
Right. And what about the Arab parties in Israel? Now they're also part of the coalition for the first time in history. Will conditions in Israel improve for their supporters?
Well, only one Arab party, a very opportunistic party led by a man called Mansour Abbas, joined the government. And even one of his members, I think they have, you know, three or four members, even one of his members abstained. But this is token representation of Arabs in the government. And indeed, it is being used to whitewash the true nature of this Israeli government. The vast majority of Palestinian citizens of Israel would not support this government, and indeed the majority of lawmakers from the Palestinian community in Israel did not vote for this government.
Ali, and just briefly, I don't have much time, but I want to ask you this. What about the other Arab nations? I mean, we've seen warming of relations with Israel among some of them. Is this likely to change?
Well, I think that's not affected by the change in government. That's affected by the strength of the Palestinian resistance that we saw in the last month or so, which proved to those Arab dictatorships that the Palestinian cause is alive and well, and the Palestinian people are still struggling for their liberation, because those unrepresentative dictatorships that made deals with Israel were betting on the idea that the Palestinian cause is dead and that the Palestinians can do nothing, so you might as well get into bed with Israel. That was a huge miscalculation on their part.
Ali, thank you so much for that insight for us here at TRT World. I appreciate he's a co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine book. Thank you again.
That was Ali Abunima speaking from Amman, Jordan. And now on to our feature presentation. Today we hear from scholar, author, activist, and professor at UCLA, R.C. Kelly, talking about pro-Palestinian campus activism and the pushback by the Israeli lobby to silence criticism of Israel. He draws attention to the intersectionality movement, which is linking together the struggles of all oppressed people to stand against apartheid, colonization, white supremacy, racism, and imperialism. This linkage is giving enormous energy to the Palestinian movement, which for too long has suffered in unique isolation. As oppressed people around the world see that the colonization and occupation of Palestine is their story as well, the struggle for Palestinian rights will gain visibility and the international pressure on Israel intensify. Hopefully, our black civil rights leaders and black legislators in the United States will increasingly see the parallels of Palestinian apartheid to the U.S. Jim Crow system and cut their ties to Israel to support the liberation of Palestine. That is what has to happen, and we have a huge role to play in that process as we work collaboratively to move our leadership. This morning we feature UCLA Professor R.C. Kelly speaking to this very issue at a forum sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. It begins with his introduction.
I'm Janet McMahon with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and our next speaker is Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly. He is the Gary B. Nash Professor of American History at UCLA, where he earned his master's and doctorate degrees. He has also taught at the University of Southern California, Columbia University, NYU, and Oxford University. Dr. Kelly's research has explored, among other topics, the history of American social movements, the African diaspora in Africa, African-American intellectuals, music and visual culture, and surrealism and Marxism. His essays have appeared in a wide variety of professional and general interest publications, and he's the author of many books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, Race Rebels, Culture, Politics, and the Black Working Class, and Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Originalist. He's currently writing a biography of the late journalist and author Grace Halsell, who was a great friend of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and whose many articles she wrote for our magazine are archived on our website, WRMEA.org. In fact, we first met Robin when he visited our office as part of his research for his biography of Grace. A member of the board of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, Dr. Kelly will be discussing efforts to resist Israel's lobby on campus and in the community. And as a reminder, you can submit questions through the Q&A function on the Zoom screen or email ask@israellobbycon.org. And with that, it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Robin D. Kelly on what's been a very busy day for him so far.
Yes, thank you so much, Janet. I appreciate that the introduction. And I apologize, you know, I'm doing two conferences at once. I just gave a talk on Rosa Luxemburg. Then I fled. I said, I can't take questions. Sorry. So they're kind of mad at me. So I want to thank the organizers for inviting me, especially Janet and Delinda and all the folks at IRMEP. I have a very tall order of things to address in 20 minutes. So I'm going to get right on it. With respect to resistance to the Israel lobby on campuses, there's so much going on. I'm in no position to report on all of it, but I would suggest two things. One, always read the excellent reporting of Nora Barrows Friedman on this. And also Palestine Legal, of which I'm a member of the board, does an excellent job of monitoring and actually fighting ongoing attacks on students and faculty who dare criticize Israel or stand up for Palestinian rights. In fact, just in 2020 alone, Palestine Legal responded to 213 incidents of suppression of U.S.-based Palestine advocacy. And two-thirds of them, not surprisingly, involve cases of students or faculty who are falsely accused of anti-Semitism for merely supporting Palestinian rights. So, irrespective of new definitions of anti-Semitism, we've been dealing with the kind of smear campaigns for years. And of course, Israel lobby groups like the Lawfare Project and the Zionist Advocacy Center have, you know, filed lawsuits and used the federal civil rights complaint process to make unfounded claims to silence campus Palestine advocacy. And also we've seen the legislature being used. 21 bills were introduced at the state and federal levels targeting the movement for Palestinian rights. And on college campuses and elsewhere, we see cyberbullying and surveillance, which has really intensified with Israel-funded smartphone apps designed to generate mass smear campaigns against activists with maximum effect and in record time. I won't, because time is short, there's a couple cases you might want to look at. The use of the app Mission on ACT IL was used after SJP chapter at Tufts University was recognized with an award for its work on End the Deadly Exchange campaign, which looks at, which really exposed the links between campus police and the Israeli military. And the administration attacked the SJP for getting the award. And then there was this kind of Zionist attack on students on social media using this app. And then also some of you may be familiar with the case at Florida State University where Ahmad Daldik, a Palestinian American student who grew up in the West Bank and had tweeted, you know, as a teenager about the kind of what life was like under occupation. He was attacked. And there's a movement to recall him after he was elected the FSU Student Senate President in June 2020. And there's lots of cases like this, you know. But what's really important is that the heightened attacks we're seeing are reactions to losing. They're not necessarily signs that the kind of Zionist position or the Israeli lobbies are winning. They have not been able to silence SJP or the BDS campaign to divert university endowments from businesses operating in occupied territories or even ending the exchanges with Israeli universities. When SJP held a national conference on my campus, UCLA, a couple of years ago, it was not only violently attacked by various Zionist organizations, but Kenneth Marcus, who was Trump's appointee to the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, opened an investigation into what had happened. And in fact, was demanding a list of speakers, the list of speakers at the conference, and threatened to punish the students. And Powell Legal intervened. And ultimately, a court ruled that the administration has no legal claim to that list. And that was kind of a victory. And similarly, when Marcus's outfit investigated SJP at NYU, again, triggered by Israel advocates, you know, they found no wrongdoing. But since they couldn't really prosecute until they found no wrongdoing, they convinced NYU's president to issue a statement prohibiting discrimination based on the Trump executive order adopting the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. And just to be clear, the college presidents have been at the forefront of doing the bidding of the lobby. And that includes Black presidents like, you know, Melvin Oliver of Pitzer College, who vetoed the college council's overwhelming decision to temporarily suspend study abroad program with Haifa University. And his neighbor here in California, the new president of Pomona College, G. Gabriel Starr, also African-American, who essentially condemned student government unanimous adoption of a BDS resolution with regard to student government funds. So usually it's kind of like the same kind of response. And there are other things we could talk about, but I'm going to skip all that and turn to the other issue, which is the parallels between South Africa and the movement toward Palestinian liberation, as well as solidarity with Black Lives Matter. So first, no matter what, the term apartheid is applicable to Israel, especially when we consider the UN definition of apartheid, which is not, of course, limited to South Africa alone. Most people on this call know this already, so I don't have to repeat it. But just a reminder that apartheid, you know, did more than strip South Africans of voting and civil rights. It dispossessed Africans from land through legislative and military acts, raised entire communities, transferred Africans to government townships and to Bantustans. And it devised a system of racial classification and population control that limited the movement of Africans in towns and cities and denied them social and economic privileges based on race. So I could describe what's happening both within the 48 boundaries as well as the occupied territories. And I just want to point to the way in which it not only outlawed organizations that challenged apartheid or the apartheid state, but, you know, without recounting the litany of legislative acts, I want to suggest some of the findings of Nora Ericott in her brilliant book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, which shows that whereas the world condemned South Africa's Bantustan policies under the guise of granting some limited independence or state status, proponents of the two-state solution celebrate the creation of the Palestinian Authority. And there's a kind of refusal to recognize this as apartheid, as a Bantustan policy, as the late Edward Said called it. Okay. Now, one question is, you know, how are Black Lives Matter and Palestinian grassroots movements working together, and are they natural allies? And this is something I've written a lot about, but this is like the thumbnail sketch. The recognition that the subjugation of Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and within the 48 borders of Israel, is you know, that these are kind of apartheid policies, or it is an act of apartheid, became increasingly clear to African-American activists. It has been clear for a while, but especially since about 2010, 2011, when you have more and more African-American activists joining delegations to Palestine. And out of these encounters, there are a whole bunch of new organizations emerged that linked Israeli apartheid to anti-Black racism, supporting BDS, and also emphasizing Black Palestinian solidarity. The turning point, of course, was the Gaza-Ferguson nexus in 2014, which deepened the relationship between Palestinians, especially in St. Louis and across the country, as well as in Palestine, as they stood in solidarity with the protests around the killing of Mike Brown. And then 2016, the Movement for Black Lives, which is a coalition of over 100 organizations, issued quite a forceful statement labeling Israel an apartheid state and characterizing the ongoing war in Gaza and the West Bank as a form of genocide. The parallels of state-sanctioned violence, both in Palestine and occupied territories and the U.S., became a basis for solidarity, but it also gave way to a kind of politics of analogy. And as I've written elsewhere, analogies can be really useful, but they can also obscure more than they reveal. And I think it's important to understand this question of solidarity, especially Black, Brown, and Indigenous solidarity with Palestine, with Palestinians, requires that we move beyond analogies and recognize a longstanding vision of the indivisibility of justice. The basis for solidarity is not analogy, but the realization that these struggles are linked, not only to each other, but to injustice and to oppression around the world. The relationship is more entangled than analogous. Indivisibility of justice means it knows no boundaries. It's founded not on shared experience, but shared principles. And that's why to really understand it, we need to go back and recognize that the foundation for Black Palestinian solidarity really goes back to the 1960s and 70s, when we thought of the Palestinian liberation movement as a national liberation movement. And it's true that the context was resistance to racialized state sanctioned violence, the ghetto rebellions of the U.S. in the late 60s and early 70s, resistance to occupation, the linking of these things. But these were armed struggles against brutal military regimes. So the convergence of Black urban rebellions and the Arab-Israeli war birthed the first significant wave of Black Palestinian solidarity and signaled the demise of the U.S. Quote-unquote Black Jewish alliance. And I should say that there are many Black Jewish alliances. The idea that there's a singular one is a mistake. The Communist Party itself was a kind of Black Jewish alliance that operated within it. But most importantly, that the more traditional civil rights-based Black Jewish alliance was still founded on the notion of shared analogy, right? Analogy of oppression rather than shared principles of liberation. And that's why, you know, within the left, you do get a segment of anti-Zionist Jews breaking with Zionist Jews, on the left that have a different relationship to Black liberation struggles. That is to say, you know, third world insurgencies and anti-imperialist movements radically reordered the political alliances between 1967 and the mid-1970s. But what was being reordered wasn't just political alliances, but really a vision of the world. The post-67 radical insurgencies were more nationalist struggles for a modern nation state as a path of decolonization, but they also ought to be understood as kind of world-making rather than nation-building. So behind these Black expressions of solidarity with Palestine lay a vision of world-making rather than a politics of analogy or identity. Okay, so the hardest question to answer, which I don't really have a good answer, because I hope that we can discuss it in our conversation. And the final thing I just want to talk about is that, you know, what are the lessons we can learn for today's activists? One really important lesson, of course, is that, you know, as our demands, you know, as movements, especially coming out of the anti-police protests of spring 2020, the George Floyd protests, the struggle against fascism in this country, that the return of indigenous sovereignty, the abolition of police and prisons, I mean, these are the kinds of demands being raised, that alongside all these, or central to all these, is the fight against Israel's annexation of Palestinian lands and the ongoing occupation. And that in part requires the defunding of the Israeli apartheid military state, which of course, defunding that side of the police is about withdrawing all funds from the United States, which is the ongoing fight that all of you have been engaged in. I think the other lesson is that BDS actually does work. We saw this with South Africa, along with the kind of labor and civil society insurgencies, really brought down the formal apartheid state. I mean, there's still problems with South Africa, but what I think is really important to remember is that South Africa responded to BDS with reforms. So you have this new constitution being implemented in 1984, which extended limited voting rights to so-called colored people, to Indians, and opened up the door. But BDS didn't stop then. In fact, it ramped up. And so it ramped up. And in fact, most of the successes of the BDS movement in South Africa occur after the adoption of reforms, where, you know, 1985, where 50 companies pulled out of South Africa, Citibank pulls out, declares that it would not make loans to South Africa after 1985. Chase Manhattan did the same thing. So 86, you begin to see even more movements out. So that's to say that even though a lot of us are rethinking the BDS movement, the best strategy, it's something that should continue to be fought, even if it doesn't appear to produce like immediate results. And finally, and this is not so much a lesson as much as a warning. I mean, Palestine always, and this has been said by several of the speakers, Palestine, when it comes to some of these solidarity movements in the U.S., tends to ebb and flow. In moments of spectacular violence, like, you know, Gaza in 2014 or 2009, I mean, we see a kind of interest emerging and then a kind of ebb and flow. With the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, you know, the fear of the Trump administration and its relationship to Israel, the no daylight, the insistence that they recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, all this led to a kind of increase of interest. But with a Democratic regime in power, there may be a kind of ebb, which we can't afford right now. And so my concern always is that as we fight to transform policing in this country, as we fight to end all forms of oppression, that Palestine never leave its role as a central side of struggle, in that we continue to raise our voices around this in fight, because you know, we're not free until, you know, Palestine is free. And that is why, again, our struggles are not analogous as so much linked. And so with that, I'll stop. I know there's a lot of things I skipped over, but I figured we have some time for a conversation before people are all worn out.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm having trouble starting my video, so I think you'll just be hearing my voice for the immediate future. But one thing I wanted to ask you about concerns BDS, and I remember boycotting South Africa, and I was never called anti-Christian or anti-white. But when it comes to boycotting Israel, it becomes the discussion of anti-Semitism.
Absolutely.
And I'm also struck by Reverend Awad's observation that Christian Zionists, their support of Israel is based on their belief in the prophecy. So in neither case is the discussion about behavior. I mean, to me, a boycott is in response to certain behaviors. So I'm curious what you think, how can we reframe the discussion about BDS to just have it almost be automatically Pavlovian response, like it's about behavior, it's not about who's doing it even really.
Right. Well, that's why the anti-Semitism assertions are the most powerful weapon they have. In fact, it's the only weapon they have. It's the only weapon they have because it's the one thing that gets brought out all the time. Because you're right. Anti-Semitism is not necessarily used against the apartheid state and anti-Afrikaner, none of that. There's a way in which is, you know, you can claim the moral high ground when it comes to South Africa because it is strictly racial. And that's why U.S. foreign policy was always about hiding its intent. You know, that is constructive engagement as a secret, as opposed to like an open. So in the case of Israel, I mean, this is why this fight against the continual use of anti-Semitism as a epithet, the redefinition of it, you know, is the biggest hurdle we're facing because they refuse to talk about policy. Like I've never seen, you know, the Israeli state representative saying, we're going to show you pictures of just how good life is under occupation. You know, I mean, at least the U.S. South, they tried some of that. They tried to use propaganda to show, you know, actually, look, they have farms. The olive trees are growing well. You know, no one's being displaced. But instead, it's like, if you criticize us, you're anti-Semitic. And we will continue to build settlements. So that to me, and this is what I think we're all here for, to figure out strategies to do that. But I do think that there has been some significant successes. I mean, no matter what people might think about the Jerusalem Declaration, it is a step forward in a kind of refusal to say strictly, I mean, for all of its limitations and problems, that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. Even as much as I haven't been attacked by having criticized ADL, even the ADL had to backpedal a little bit to say that there's some circumstances where criticism of Israel is acceptable. And I don't really believe that struggle is always incremental, but these small victories and the fact that SJP chapters are growing, not shrinking, that that there are more hotspots both on campuses and within various other social and public institutions where people are taking stands, I think are important. And final thing is, you've got some mainstream Democratic Congress people who are slightly to the left who are actually saying, you know, Elizabeth Warren, you know, who hasn't had a great position on Israel, I have to say, is actually considering like maybe we should withhold some money. I mean, you know, that's as a victory, it's sort of like saying, you know, we're so happy that Derek Chauvin is going to go to jail, you know, after killing someone on camera. But it is some evidence that there might be a kind of ideological shift that could tamp down the anti-Semitism arguments or assertions. But I think that's always going to be the ground of struggle, that right there.
Well, and kind of a related question is, how have the tactics of the lobby changed over the decades? You've been through a lot with them, so I'm just curious how you see it all.
Yeah, you know, I can tell you the long decades, but I can tell you the last decade we're in. I mean, when I, after my first trip to Palestine, that coincided with both the direct attacks on SJP chapters and on specifically targeting, communities of color. And that was a tactic. That was, you know, they created the Vanguard Leadership Group and groups like that, where they would use tours of Israel, money, jobs, opportunities to try to make the Zionist position multiracial, multicultural, and to be all inclusive. And it actually was, I wouldn't say successful, but what it did do was it was trying to siphon off those people identified with their own kind of ethnic and racial struggles, anti-police struggles and stuff, and bring them into the fold and create a presentation of Israel, whether it's through pink washing or, you know, ethnic studies, to sort of say, you know, we're with you. We're like you. It's not a new strategy, because if you go back to the post-war period, Israel presented itself after the Nakba as, you know, another third world country. And they were trying to have alliances with the global South, and it didn't quite work. So in some ways, this is like a miniature version of that. And it didn't work. It didn't work because what happened was people began to see through it, especially through more and more delegations. And with the BDS campaign as a nonviolent civil society campaign, a lot of people who were not necessarily down with armed struggle or even thought about national liberation could identify with that, because it connected with South Africa in some direct ways. So now it seems to me that they haven't given up, but it's a failing strategy. And what I see, at least in terms of strategy and tactics, is to go after directly activists, to try to smear them, to create websites, to destroy their careers, to try to, you know, create false narratives so they can't get jobs or get into schools, to use social media as a way to literally name people and bring them down. It's a warfare tactic that is quite violent. And I don't think it's so they're not really trying to win friends in this sense. What they're trying to do is destroy the enemy and then mark the enemy, you know, as dangerous, you know, and as wanting to destroy, you know, all Jews everywhere in the world, to destroy Israel. And we saw, so there's that, but there's also a kind of, it's been raised earlier in the discussion, of Phil Weiss's discussion of J Street, which is a kind of kinder, friendlier, more progressive, like let's find a middle ground strategy, which is very different. So you have these breakaway groups from AIPAC and the more traditional form of lobbying to more left liberal, more liberal approaches. And we saw that in California recently with the rewriting of the ethnic studies curriculum, where the state of California, through all kinds of pressures, is trying to adopt a statewide ethnic studies curriculum for K through 12. And it was a very powerful curriculum that had a section on Palestine, an Arab American history, which connected to Palestine, and then it was rewritten precisely because of the lobby, and rewritten in ways that made Jewish experience both equivalent to other racialized groups and erased Palestine pretty much altogether. And, you know, incorporated elements in the curriculum that would suggest, or at least imply, that attacks on Israel is part of an anti-Semitic campaign. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that was a way in which, again, influencing the curriculum from a standpoint that appeared to be quite liberal, is another successful, or not, I don't want to say successful, but another strategy that's been adopted.
Yes, at one of our last conference, we had a presentation from Virginian activists about how the textbooks are being monitored and changed, and recommendations are submitted to modify them to fit the Zionist narrative. So that's another level things are happening on, I think, in education, certainly.
Right.
So I have another question. If ebb and flow for support of Palestinians have to do with violence, what can we do to make media report the everyday violence Israel's inflicting on Palestinians? How can we influence the mainstream media?
We can't. I shouldn't say that. Well, you know, I'm joking, but I'm not joking, because one of the things that happened with in 2014 that I think surprised everyone was the incredible courage of on the ground Palestinian journalists, Egyptian journalists, others who documented and through social media put out reportage and images that could not be ignored. And that was a turning point in 2014. That media, I mean, you know, and it's, again, not to draw any straight parallel, but we wouldn't have a Derek Chauvin trial without Darnella Frazier and the cell phone. And so I think that the idea of trying to influence mainstream media just fails every single time. I mean, even those that claim to be liberal, like MSNBC, what they do is they just ignore it. They'll just ignore the story. They won't. They'll try to avoid, you know, bringing on a lot of Israeli, you know, pro-Israeli talking heads or spokespeople, but they'll just ignore it. And so I think that alternative media is ultimately the answer. I think that a lot of us who do do intellectual work and who do activism and media work have to figure out a way to navigate to get onto these mainstream shows, but I just don't think they're going to give it up. I mean, we've seen so many studies and so many wonderful but terrifying films about the Palestine exception, about the way the media has basically had a blackout when it comes to violence against Palestinians. And, you know, it's tragic because we barely touch the surface. You know, when you think about, we talk about the occupied territories, but there's so much going on within Israel itself, you know, let alone the other forms of violence, anti-Black violence against the Somali, the East African population, the Ethiopian Jews, and, you know, the way in which some of those stories are just completely erased. But I give credit to those people on the ground who keep, you know, trying to figure out a way to get the story out. And also just the work that the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs does. You know, we've got to figure out a way to get these amazing stories in circulation, you know, not necessarily on the media, but in people's hands, you know.
Well, I think we have time for one final question. So I'm going to ask you why Grace Halsell is not better known today. She died in 2000. She wrote many books on Christian Zionism. So very relevant still. What happened to her?
Well, part of it's my fault for being so slow trying to write this book. I'm close though. I feel like I've spent so much time with her and I'm really looking forward to it. I got derailed by actual struggles going on, you know, in this country and around the world, but it'll happen. And I do think the answer is pretty clear. Grace in 1969, when Soul Sister, her book, where she darkened her skin and lived as a Black woman, came out, that was a New York Times bestseller. She was on the Today Show as almost a regular. She was, you know, internationally known. And she was making great progress writing these other books. She had op-eds in the New York Times. People knew who she was. And then she wrote a book called Journey to Jerusalem, which was not intended to be any kind of like political expose, but just like the truth about what she saw when she went to the West Bank. She was there in 1980, 81. And she published a book. And all hell broke loose. I mean, her publisher was like, we got to try to bury this book, but they published it anyway. They sent it out to quote unquote experts to try to denounce or at least contradict some of the claims that she made in the book. And she has evidence of state torture, you know, from interviews that she did, among other things. So it's a book that's not even advocacy, but it's really kind of a story of families living in the West Bank. And that pressure, that force against her, turned her into more of an activist, I think. And that's how she got involved with IMEU, which was then AMEU. That's how she got involved with you and different organizations, and wrote for Washington Report, and began to write specifically about the Christian Zionist relationship to the maintenance of the right in Israel and the ongoing occupation and violence against Palestinians. And she made that connection, and she wrote two books specifically about that. And those books did not have the imprint of a major publisher. They were small publishers. And you begin to see her footprint kind of shrink, not from anything she did, because she's a great writer, but from the pressure, the kind of Zionist pressure on her, both within the United States and elsewhere. And so now it's time to return to her work. And my book, hopefully, will do that and tell her entire story, but in the process, also tell the story of the transformation of U.S. policy toward Israel in this period, and the sacrifices she made to try to tell that story.
Well, I very much look forward to reading it, that's for sure. And I know we'll be selling it at Middle East Books and More. Okay. So I want to thank you so much again, Robin, for being with us today and for this illuminating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see everybody. Okay.
You have been listening to UCLA Professor R.C. Kelly speaking recently at a forum in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. And click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم